Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Before we get into this week's episode, we are in the middle of Heritage Radio Network's summer fundraiser drive. If you have not donated yet, please go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the donate button. Usually top right if you can't find it. Your support, your money, your help helps keeps us doing these amazing shows every week, week in, week out. Please donate $5, $10, $15 a month, whatever you can afford. There's some certain t-shirts, pins, bags. Just get in there. On this week's episode, we are joined by Christian Page, who's the chef and co-owner of the legendary lunch counter Cassell's Hamburgers. Originally opened in the 1940s, it was shuttered in 2012 until he and his partner reopened it, serving up what is one of our favorite patty melts in the city. It's a great place to go to knock back some shakes, some fries, listen to some good tunes, and just have an overall good time. Then we are joined by Hungry Ass Youth, one of our favorite hardcore bands from the San Gabriel Valley. They give a hell of a performance singing about pizza, friendship, and just all other good stuff. There's also a little bit of a Ultimate Warrior Easter egg. See if you can catch it. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are here with Christian Page, chef and owner of Cassell's Hamburgers at, we just found out, our shared squash club in Los Angeles.
Yes.
I guess if you're from the East Coast and you have any fancy for squash, this is where you wind up.
That is true. And you run into a lot of other like-minded people here, and it's definitely a much smaller universe here, and you meet some really interesting people.
It's a good club. It's a good club. You grew up in Connecticut, right?
I did.
You grew up with a garden at your house, which, not the norm in Connecticut.
No. Yeah, not, especially not in Fairfield County, but yeah, no, we had
Shout out to Fairfield.
we had huge gardens, actually, at our house, and once you at a certain age, you get to get your own plot.
Wait, define huge.
You'd have probably, we had like about an acre, wow, acre and a half, and probably, you know, a good third of it was devoted to, you know, produce and chickens and rabbits. And
so very bucolic,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of apple trees and crab apple trees that you made jam from. We had a raspberry patch, a blueberry patch, an asparagus patch, which is not something you hear of very often.
Not at all.
It takes 7 years to get that thing to fruit.
In those early years, were as like indentured servitude until you earned the right
thing. You got your own plot.
like, all right, mom, dad, I've worked off the debt. And when you got your own plot, did you like teenage style it? Like, ah, fuck you, mom and dad. Like, I'm going to make...
I'm growing weed.
We got blackberries. We got weed. What did you plant? What did you grow?
When I got my own plot, basically, I built a really cool garden, high walls, because you got to keep all those crazy deer out in Connecticut. Oh, yeah. You know, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And I just got prolific with it, you know. I had things growing up the walls. I had strings going atop, and all of the like trellised plants that you could do, like cucumbers and melons and tomatoes, were all just growing across the top of it in a crisscross. It was a pretty cool place to hang out.
I mean, growing up and literally growing your own food in Connecticut was probably a different experience than your fellow classmates. Did it give you a different appreciation for food younger on? How did that follow you through life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was that, and I also I raised bees with my dad. And when you would call the cops and you had a bee swarm at your house, it was me and my dad who would show up with our crazy hats and gloves and steal the queen into the box and take your bees back to our place and add another super. But it definitely just gave me a deeper appreciation for ingredients. And back then, in Connecticut, you know, if you went to the grocery store, you weren't going to get, like, a necessarily beautiful produce, right?
I mean, this was, what years, I mean...
I don't mind dating myself. But this, just turned 40 this weekend.
But this was not the era like, the Whole Foods and, like, the organic grocery.
No, you didn't
like
have
that.
It. Yeah. It was the Atlantic and Pacific, the AMP market.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the
Pathways and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tomatoes weren't vine ripe. They were ripening with, what do they spray them with? I don't know. Nitrogen or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, and stuff didn't have as much flavor. So I could even as a young kid, you could really taste the difference between if you bought something at the store, if it was something that you had grown over the growing season. Obviously, in the winter, you went to the store.
Did you cook a lot at home, too? Did you guys use that? Or was it, what was it? I mean, what was the purpose of having that big of a garden and having your own bees? You know, was mom and dad really into
it? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess they were just into it. I mean, my dad wasn't into food business. He was in finance. But I think, you know, their parents, you know, probably the same thing. My grandfather had bees and had big gardens. And I think it was just a appreciation for food. And it's also a... You know, it's a very zen thing to do.
Especially working in finance.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like a carrot's going to grow the way a carrot's going to grow. You don't always have that same control over the markets.
Yeah.
So was it being around food and having that appreciation for it, is that what led you going to culinary school?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and also I started cooking a lot when I was younger. You know, my mom would cook dinner and, you know, if it was something you didn't like, she would basically, I have five brothers and sisters too. And she'd just tell you, you know, if you don't like it, you better learn how to cook. So I took her up on that. And she actually started taking me to cooking classes when I was young. The first class I ever went to was like a pastry and chocolate class when I was like 12 or 13 years old. And I remember feeling like super embarrassed when I went into this class. And it's, you know, there was, you know, I was the only young person there. Everybody there had to be, you know, at least, you know, 40 years old. And But they like really embraced having a young kid in there and really having fun with it. And since that, I just kept going. I started working in restaurants when I was 14, cooking. Like
you're actually cooking?
Yeah. One of a teacher in my school owned a restaurant also, and so that he let me come work. I mean, you probably weren't supposed to work when you were 14.
No. It was a different time.
It was a different time.
It's when you could be a dishwasher and then work your way up to being a line cook, yeah. You know, and it's like...
I washed a lot of dishes.
I mean, I started in restaurants too, you know, and I was like, should I be using the deli slicer? And they're like, just be careful of those fingers.
That guy's not here today, so yeah, we're going to need you to use the deli slicer.
there was so much of that, of those classic stories of where he's not here, so you get bumped up and then you just stay up.
Yep. That's how I got onto the hotline is I would work Sundays and nobody else, of course, wanted to work Sundays. I didn't think about it being a kid.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and it's Sunday, and so the guys who are supposed to work on the hotline on Sundays, they'd get fucked up on Saturday.
Yeah. So you're there. One of the things I like about you going to... In addition to cooking schools, that you also went to business school, which I feel like is a huge missing thing about education and going into restaurant or getting into the field. Why did you want to go do both? Or were your parents like, you can go to cooking school, but you also have to go to business school?
Well, it actually started out more like my dad being like, you can go to business school. If you want to go to cooking school, you can pay for cooking school.
Sure.
And he took me on college tours, like took me all around the East Coast looking at different colleges. And I was like, holy shit, this is what they do in college?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'll go to college. This is a lot easier.
Yeah.
So I went to college, had a blast, but was still working in restaurants. And when I got out, I decided, you know, like I worked in finance for a couple years and then I decided, or actually for a year. And then I decided I wanted to go to culinary school. Like I was like, oh, I should have just gone to culinary school.
Yeah.
Bet they have fun too. So I went to culinary school, French Culinary Institute in Manhattan. Now the International Culinary Center, I believe.
Yeah.
So I went there. It was an awesome experience. I went there at nights while I was still working in finance during the day. And then I started working in restaurants at night while still working in finance during the day.
Where were you working?
I did stints at Savoy. And then I actually met Brian Bistrong, who is the chef of the Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
And we became really good friends. And then I really just worked at the Harrison for the rest of the time. Started a catering business. And then was still working in finance. I kind of couldn't get myself away from the money.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about probably polar opposites as far as the paychecks.
Yeah.
But then what eventually won food over? And did you know that because of this business that owning a restaurant was going to have to be part of the ultimate deal? Just being like a line cook somewhere wasn't going to be enough.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why I decided like to just... I just said, I'm just going to completely extract myself from the East Coast. So I came over here. I went to business school at USC, and I figured that would give me like sort of networking opportunity to find and meet people. And, you know, I knew I had enough cooking chops that I could get it done and do some pretty cool things. And I've been cooking a long time. And so I came over, went to USC for business school, which basically is 2 years of people telling you not to open a restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, it's they're like, well, you can open up a restaurant or you can just put your money into this fire pit. It's the same result. But, you know, at that time to go from New York, which was really the epicenter of food in America at that time, to L.A., which was not at all what it is today. Was that a consideration at all? Did you see more opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of my job for finance, I used to come out to LA a couple times a quarter, really. And so I started looking at the food scene out here, and I was going to the green markets and everything, and just blown away.
I mean, look, Danny Meyer did a nice job with Union Square, but it's not like Santa Monica.
Yeah. It's just not. And also, it's not all year round like it is out here. It's crazy. So I figured, you know what? Like, I'll go there. I don't know anybody. I knew one person from my college who had moved out here. And I didn't know anybody else. And I figured it was a great way to just go out and just have a fresh start and reinvent yourself and just do what I wanted to do and no outside influence. And, you know, so far so good.
Yeah. So when you were out here, were you cooking at all, or how did you get yourself immersed into the food scene in LA?
So, you know, I went to USC. While I was at USC, I was networking with, you know, people who were around who were in restaurants, and it wasn't really funnily enough, the first person who I met and helped open a restaurant was someone I met playing squash.
Mm. It's a good game for that type of stuff.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised.
Right?
I'm surprised that more parents don't have their kids play squash. I feel like you get into college that way.
Yeah. Oh, you absolutely get into college that way. Yeah. They got whole programs now just to help you get into college.
I see the USC playing guys squash. Playing on our courts.
Yeah.
Yep. Maybe that's why they're so beat up.
I was actually the conditioning coach for the squash team when I was in grad school.
Oh, nice.
Because I just needed other things to do besides grad school and, you know, to entertain myself. And I used to travel around with those guys, and fuck, man, made me wish I played squash in college.
I know, man. I know. So you met a squash buddy, and he got you into the food world?
Well, and he wasn't in the food world yet, you know, but he really wanted to open a restaurant. So I met a squash buddy. We started going around and, like, you know, doing a real, like, buying direct from all the farms thing. Sure. And getting into all that. Then we opened a little cafe. And but soon after that, I decided that kind of wasn't for me. You know, it was like a partnership, and like a lot of partnerships and relationships, they can end.
They can end. They can end poorly.
They can really end poorly.
You know, look when it's high stress and the money and the margins are tight, you get to see who people really are.
Yeah.
And quickly too.
Absolutely.
And then you go, did I see that personality on the court when you lost a point? Maybe
you
I did.
You know what? I think I
Maybe
did.
I think I did see that. All right. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about you getting involved with Short Order. And then we'll talk about how you get involved with Cassell's. We have a song from the archives here on Heritage Radio Network on Snacky Tunes. Enjoy.
Never sign.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We're here with Christian Page, chef and owner of Cassell's Hamburgers. So you're in LA, you got the business degree, you've done cooking school, you've had your first cafe and partnership over with. How did you get involved with Bill Chait, Nancy Silverton, and Short Order?
So I had really gotten into the whole farm to table scene, and I was going around and I was buying a lot of grass fed beef direct from ranches and breaking it down and buying the whole pigs and doing that type of thing.
And what year is this? Just so, because people like, yeah. This was not common.
No. Yeah, this is like 2009, 2010.
It's amazing what people take for granted that 9-10 years ago was crazy.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, people would come just to watch us. So to that point, when my brother was a butcher, he flew out here, so he was helping break down these whole cuts of beef because it's not an easy thing to do. And back then, there wasn't really a lot of people who knew how to do it. He worked as like a commercial butcher.
Right.
I mean, he was working in a very nice plant in Colorado, so they were doing a lot of high quality product. He was killing and cutting, you know, I don't even know, 10, 20, 30 beef a day. I mean, crazy stuff. He's super fast. He wasn't artisanal butcher, right?
Yeah.
It was hanging from the hook and he was getting into it like real fast and ripping it apart. It's actually really interesting to watch because it's still very precise. It's an extremely precise thing. But not sort of laid out on the chef's table
Come in here. We have Vivaldi playing.
But I turned him into that. So we were doing that, and we went and started cooking. I started cooking as a chef at Bill Chait's Test Kitchen. Somebody tapped me to come over there and cook. And so I was cooking a bunch of dinners there, and we were always upstairs while the restaurant was going on downstairs, and we'd be breaking down quarters of beef and breaking down pigs and doing interesting things. And, you know, I guess it caught some people's eye when we were doing that. And Amy Pressman, who was the original chef and the person who had the concept of Short Order and Shortcake, was interested to find an executive chef. And so she looked to me to be a possible person to help out. And then Nancy was talking to some Christian Schaefer from Rocker Brothers and asking her, like, who knew about, like, a lot about beef and a lot about that. And he had mentioned my name also, and so I went to meet with Nancy and Amy and Bill, and we all talked, and we realized we all had very similar food philosophies, and that mine worked well with what they were trying to do with Short Order.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting involved like that, and we opened that restaurant. It was a beast, and you know, I was lucky that they took a chance on me because it was a huge operation for somebody that, you know, frankly didn't have that much experience with something that big. Now there was a lot of people involved. We learned a lot of things really quickly.
Also you had the luck of also being at the farmer's market, which meant that you had a great sort of set crowd who was coming no matter what.
You know, you would think that's a good location, but it's not.
Really?
So back then you didn't really have Uber like you have now.
Yeah.
You have a undersized parking lot for the original farmer's market for what it is. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that wanted to come there, but wouldn't deal with the obstacle of the parking in order to get there. So the people would come, they would enjoy it, but it was difficult to come back as often as they'd probably like because you had to deal with that crazy parking there. I don't know if you've ever parked at the farmer's market, but they'll literally back into your spot.
Oh, yeah. It's gotten better. They put in that high-rise parking structure.
Yeah, for the Grove. Yeah.
So you're there. I mean, if you said you learned a lot, what's one or two lessons that you learned that maybe upended your thinking?
I mean, you realize that location, location, location is still the most important thing.
Sure.
And it doesn't mean that you need to be in a prime location, but it means that your location needs to work. You need to have the right access.
You know,
you need to have a compelling location, which it was a compelling location and a beautiful build out. So it was a really nice place to hang out. We had great food. And then, you know, there was, it's really difficult to service a 2-story restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy to be buying whole beef when your walk-in is on the second floor.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were carrying, you know, 300-pound pieces of meat up the stairs.
Yeah.
And other than that, I mean, a lot of things were amazing about it. I mean, it was the first time that, for myself, that I'd really seen like a craft cocktail program mixed into a craft, but like, casual
burger place.
Yeah, to a burger place.
Yeah,
but it worked. I mean, we sold so many cocktails, and we sold so little wine.
That's how you keep the lights on.
Yeah,
I mean, those margins on cocktails are a beautiful thing.
Yeah, but I always thought you would sell wine and beer and not as many cocktails, but you know, wine was really low and beer and cocktails were high, and you'd seen that trend as just, you know, proliferated now.
So you were there for about 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm. I was there for about 3 years. Yeah.
When did you decide that it was time to go? I mean, you're working with arguably a few of the best well-known restaurateurs in all of LA. You have a successful place. You're doing stuff. You have this great opportunity. What made you want to change?
Well, I learned a lot from Bill. I learned a ton from Nancy. I learned a lot from Amy. And also learned a lot from running a bakery with a wholesale program that we built, and from running a whole animal butchery program at the restaurant, and learned a ton about wood fire and you know, how to run a restaurant that's doing a lot of volume. And you know, it just, like you said, at some point ownership had to become part of the plan.
Yeah.
And you know, there I felt like we had gotten to like the level that restaurant was going to get to. And it was time to sort of move on and do my own project. And I had been looking at this space with Jingbo Liu, who's my partner now at Cassell's. And it was a really interesting opportunity. And, you know, it was a location that he was really believed in. And Sed Moses had already signed on to do the bars at his hotel. He was redoing the Hotel Normandy.
Yeah. So for people who are unfamiliar, mm-hmm. let's break it down too. For people who are unfamiliar with Cassell's, what is the history of Cassell's?
So Cassell's is a brand that's been around since 1948. And before there was so much food press as there is now, it was getting international food press for just having the best hamburger. It was a lunch counter that was in what is now called Koreatown,
mm-hmm.
which is it was a couple blocks down from the Hotel Normandy.
And shout out to Al Cassell,
mm-hmm.
who opened it up, iconic lunch counter. And then, who is Jingbo?
Jingbo is an architect and accidental hotelier. He now has the hotel, and he's also now a restaurateur, and he's just an all-round good guy.
And then finally, Hotel Normandy. What is that? And what is that complex there?
So Hotel Normandy had gone through many iterations since 1926, and Jingbo is a historic restoration architect. So he was taking what had started out as a really beautiful hotel back in 1926, had turned into many different things, an old folks home, then a weed hotel, and then basically a flop house.
Mm.
And he decided that he was going to restore this hotel in Koreatown, which is a booming spot now. But years ago, nobody was thinking about that. You know?
Koreatown's like the hip spot.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, he redid the hotel. He wanted to put in sort of a classic, something classic and some kind of American food. Just thinking that there's already enough Korean food around in Koreatown. Yeah. So he wanted to put something in American. And so, you know, we had agreed on that, and we decided to develop that brand together. And so, you know, it was for me, once I saw the whole picture, I said, okay, let's give it a shot. And you know, it turned out to be a really good location as the whole neighborhood around us evolved with us. So at first, honestly, we weren't quite sure what we were doing. We were trying to keep it real to what the original concept was. It got so famous because Al Cassell would be there every day in the window, grinding the meat in the morning, yeah. and then they'd be cooking the burgers in the afternoon. And we, you know, I was knew how to grind meat, knew how to do all that, and so it transferred well. The only difference, of course, is we grind the meat in the walk-in, so it's, yeah. it's a little safer.
And it stays nice and cold.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you balance that? Because, you know, you bought essentially, which is a heritage brand mm-hmm. that people love,
mm-hmm.
and people probably think they know better than you. Which, let's be fair, the customers that have been going there for 30 years probably have their own opinions about the burgers, the potato salad, the french fries,
and
like that. So how do you balance that respect for the heritage, but reinvent it and add your own stamp on it?
Yeah, well, I mean, so you know, during the process of, you know, figuring out what the brand was, what it was going to be, you know, we did a lot of research. You know, we talked with some of the old cooks, we read through all the old recipes, and we made sure that the core of the menu is the same menu that was there before.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the grilled ham and cheese, we've got the tuna melt, we've got the potato salad.
By the way, love the tuna melt.
Thank you. But what we did was we took, like, the idea of what made the burger famous and what, you know, things I had learned along the way, which from Nancy was, you know, poaching tuna and pickle juice. Mm. And so we do that. We get fresh albacore loins, poach it in pickle juice. And then, you know, we still make our own mayo, just like we did at Schroeder, just like Alcacel did at Cassell's. And you mix it and you keep it very simple. And so to us, since it's going to be now a 3-day part restaurant for a hotel, you know, we had to re-envision the menu, and it's a pretty easy step to say, look, it was a classic hamburger lunch counter, and let's just turn it into a classic Americana diner.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's great. You know, breakfast I get to jump to, that's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for dinner, though?
Dinner, it's the same menu. We toyed around with the idea of adding other things to the menu, but in this location, in this iteration of it, it seems like it works the way it is.
Yeah.
People like it the way it is, and you just don't need to fuss with it too much.
At the end of the day, you really just want a hamburger and fries in your hotel room.
Yeah, like, and you're exactly.
Like, you're like, maybe I'll get the you know, the shrimp salad or something. It's like, no, you want to shut the door, you want to have a glass of bourbon, and eat a hamburger in the
exactly.
bathroom. So what made you decide to open up a secondary location in downtown L.A.? You know, you got a popular restaurant. It's always tough to have lightning strike twice. What goes into that decision?
Well, I mean, I've lived in downtown for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I was always wanting to have something down here.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was more of what we thought was a good location came along. Our good friend Sed Moses had that space. He had a pizzeria there next to the Gopher.
Yeah.
He just kind of wasn't interested in operating the pizzeria anymore, and so we made a deal and took over the space. And we had kind of been sitting on it for a little while. We were thinking, oh, well, should we put something else there, or should we put another Cassell's there? And then that whole strip on 8th between Olive and Hill just, you know, started getting developed, and so we just hurried up and opened another Cassell's. And, you know, it's only been a few months, a couple months. And so far, so good. Just like the original Cassell's, we're still waiting for our liquor license.
Wow.
But once we get it, it'll be even better.
God, the city sometimes.
Yeah.
We'll save that for the off-the-record conversation. is there any difference? Different menu items? Different approach? You know, I mean, because you're not servicing a hotel, are there things that you can do at this location versus that you can't do because you have to do, like, room service and things like that?
Well, no, I mean the only real difference is that, like, in the original location, you know, we have a full liquor license, we have a full bar program, a full coffee program. It's a bigger space. We have a beautiful patio that we just opened over there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bigger space, a bigger version of it, and this is sort of going to be like the little brother. So it's got a few less seats, but still the same cozy decor that we have over there, all the hand-painted signs, a lot of wood, the open kitchen, and it's just going to be beer and wine. If you want to get a cocktail, there's a kiosk in the Gopher, so you can order all the food that you want from Cassell's and sit over there and, you know, sip on a good cocktail or nice glass of bourbon. You can wear your bathrobe if you want.
Hey, yeah. Or maybe I can get the burger, walk down the street, and have a... be my bathrobe here at the club.
Yeah.
So what's next? What do you see on the horizon? Do you see location 3, 4, 5, or is it a whole new concept?
I think for now, you know, we've got this, and we've got the one at the airport, Terminal 1 Southwest. Mm. And so what our focus is in the near future is just trying to keep everything tight, trying to get everything stabilized and make sure the quality is right. And we're always looking for new location, you know, but we kind of have three different business models now, and we're just sort of sorting out which we want to do next. And for me, I think the full service diner model with the full cocktail program that we have is what we want to go with. And so we're on the lookout for good neighborhoods. And just like sort of Koreatown was when we went there, you know, something that's up and coming and we can get in early in that kind of neighborhood. So that's what I think would be the best next location. But there's no rush to find it.
No rush.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I've always felt that the restaurants that are here day after day are the neighborhood spots. And, you know, people like you and people like Al are the people who keep the people coming back.
Yeah, yeah. And it's important. I mean, it's like you said, you know, like how did we make sure like people who knew the brand so much longer than we did and came in all the time is so when I used to be in the restaurant and it's all, you know, glass windows on a hard corner and I'd be in there doing recipe testing and I would just leave the door open. And so when people would walk by, they would poke their head in and be like, "Oh, so you're gonna reopen Cassell's, huh?"
Yeah.
I was like, Come in.
Give me a tip.
Try that potato salad.
Well, Christian, thank you so much. If people wanna get more information on the restaurant, where can they go?
You can go to CassellsHamburgers.com. You could go to our Instagram page, you know, and come check us out.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm excited to dig into some food. And we have another song from the archives and then a live band coming up next here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
1, 2, 1, 2, ready, go.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Benrubi, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are sitting in the legendary Danger Bird Record Studios. It's finally sunny in LA, and we have a legendary food punk hardcore band from the SJV, Hungry Ass Youth. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Yo, what's up?
What's going on?
Glad to be here. Yes. I like that introduction. That was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. So the concept of hungry is this like really big idea of either being hungry in the belly, but like hungry for wanting more. And it's a big part of who you guys are and about your name. And I'd love to talk about what hungry means to you, and then also why you wanted to put that, you know, in your band name.
Well, Bina, you want to take it?
No, I was just going to say, I'll let Jesse kick it off. He's better speaking. Right.
I think you guys can just, like, the interview should just be you letting other people.
Yeah.
Josh, you want to take this? No, Flea, you take it.
No, no worries. I'll start, dude.
Yeah, kick it off.
So, growing up, you know, I grew up in an extended family. There was a lot of us in one house. And also being Latino, we love to eat. Like, I feel like our culture is very centered around eating, getting together, like sharing our stories and whatnot. So my family ate a lot, and my nickname growing up was actually Fat Ass. But it was a term of endearment. Like, it wasn't like
if right, you go, 'cause ass in your band is also a term right. of endearment. It's not.
No, well, that's the idea of like the hungry ass in youth. Has its own meaning. Like, each word has its own meaning. But getting back to like, yeah, growing up, we were very like, had a big family. We ate a lot, so my nickname was Fat Ass. My brother's nickname was Fat Boy. And then, like, if you go to a lot of households are like that. Like, the next one will be like Gorda, Gordo,
Chancho,
fucking, like, yeah. All that pretty much means in Spanish is like you're bigger, you're a little plus, you're more to hug or whatever.
But more to love,
exactly. But the actual name Hungry is a hungry for life, like a hungry for just wanting to consume anything. Would you agree, Flea?
Yeah. Well, yeah. We consume, overconsumption. I would say we eat a lot of food. We drink a lot of beer. Yeah, I would say we drink. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's like a metaphor for just a hunger for everything, a hunger for life. It could be anything, good or bad. Ass is a reference to the 90s, because back in those days, and at least in Southern California, I don't know if this was happening in New York, we would say ass for everything. Like, that's a big-ass soda. That's a big-ass pizza. That's a dumb-ass dude or whatever. Like, just ass is in the middle. So hungry ass. And then the youth was a play on all the hardcore bands that have youth in the
youth of
in
today,
their name.
Youth Brigade,
yeah. Youth of Today.
The list goes on.
Narcoleptic
forever.
Youth, like, yeah. Youth. Reagan Youth.
Yeah, we just pretty much wanted to come up with a wacky sounding band name. You know, we weren't very serious in the beginning, and then later on we did start getting a little, you know, serious. It kind of bit us in the ass because a lot of promoters kind of looked at us like, oh, this band has a dumbass name. You know,
exactly.
I don't really want to put them on my show.
When you're younger and you pick a name, you never think that like 10 years later or 15 years later, you're like, oh, crap, that name is our name now. Yep.
Or 34
years later. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing about the band. I've actually never heard this before, and I don't want to butcher the story, but
go for it.
The band actually started in the 80s, right? Or like an iteration of the band started.
Actually, to clarify that, when we first started, to get more press, we kind of fabricated a story about our beginnings.
Yeah.
And we took legit pictures because we realized that kids, at least in our time, they didn't give a crap if you were a new band barely starting out. They liked it when, the 80s? Oh, okay. So even if you sucked, if you were from the 80s, you were golden.
So what's the story?
The fabricated story?
Yeah, give us the fabricated story.
Yeah, I'll tell you. You want to give it, Flea?
Well, me and Jesse were sitting down, you know, drinking some beers, and we came up with this. We're saying, let's play a trick on the scene, whatever, whoever cares. At the time, we weren't that serious, so we came up that the original Hungry Ass Youth from the 80s was from the mid-80s.
From 86 to 88.
Yeah.
Classic.
A two-year span.
Classic hardcore year.
Exactly.
Yes. And by the way, very long time for a band back then. 2 years of a hardcore
band. Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So the story goes that it's Jesse's uncle's
band originally.
Tony Castro,
which
my
is a
fictional uncle.
Shout out to R.I.P. Tony Castro.
Yeah, yes. Tony Mega Gut. Tony, Mega his nickname was Gut. Mega Gut Castro.
Yeah, so so tragically, he died of heart failure, this fictional character.
At the
character.
Age of 27?
Damn, dude, you still remember all that shit?
No, it's about the details. Yeah, these stories only work if you know the details.
So the best part, I think, you know, I'll fucking summarize it. The best part of this shit was that we took pictures of our friends wearing like old school punk band shirts, all tore up. And they're friends that don't really kick it too much in the scene, so not anybody would recognize them. It was like one of Jesse's cousins.
Yeah, Big Pauly and Big Rick.
And Big Fat Rick, yeah.
So, names of endearment.
Yeah.
Names of endearment, exactly.
Yeah. So we took a picture of them in an alley, you know, leaning against a wall, drinking a 40, cut up clothes, and we photoshopped it where it made the picture look kind of wilted, you know, sepia toning, kind of, you know,
like 80, it looked grainy, like 80s style.
Yeah, so people started believing the story. You know, what's funny is that I had musicians who wanted to try out for drums at the time say, like, I'd like to try out for your band, but you know what, like, it's kind of intimidating, you know, you guys are from the 80s and everything, and like,
and I used to listen to those demos when I was growing up. Yeah. It's like,
oh, we had people lie to us about it too.
The funniest thing,
they had cassette tapes and all that, right?
yeah
there was a guy who asked me at a show, hey, I'd pay top dollar for the original demos. I'm a collector of old rare punk. And I was like, fuck, I wish we had something so we could sell it. Yeah.
It's like, hey, give me like a day and I have to go to Radio Shack. Yeah, and I'll be
hit record on a fucking boombox.
Yeah, dude, those old Maxwell chips, the black and gold ones. Yeah. But you guys still do pull influence from that genre of music, though. Like,
of course.
I mean, it works because when you listen to music that you guys put out, you go, yeah, this is an 80s hardcore band. Like, this has got stuff in there. What do you love about what those bands stood for? And forget the fake story, but, like, what was important to draw from those influences?
Well, in the original days, and you can hear it very clearly in the music. For example, we have a song called Hungry Ass Youth. And I remember when we recorded that song, at the time I was listening to a lot of Dak Nasty.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Dak.
They're from D.C. They have a song called, what's it called?
Can I say?
Can I say? Yeah, can I say? Because it goes.
That's not Can I Say. That's another one. Whatever. It doesn't matter.
No, that is Can I Say. That is Can I Say.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Who's right now? So the point is, whatever we were listening to at the time, so it was Dak Nasty, a lot of DRI, Suicidal, Circle Jerks. A lot of that stuff went into our music, and we realized we're not doing anything new under the sun. Like punk is, it's been played so many times, right? So we just kind of put our own little spin on it, and then the food part, like, it what kind of altered it. It's what made it, like, unique.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Descendants was a huge influence on Hungry Ass Youth.
Yep.
Can you want to elaborate on that, Fleek?
Well, growing up, Descendants were one of my favorite bands, still are. I've always liked that they can fucking write a song called I Like Food or Wiener Schnitzel.
Oh,
you know,
I like food tastes good.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
So the simplicity of, like, that short-ass song, I just thought, you know, we can be trying to write, like, Metallica shit or fucking, you know, write short songs about the stuff that is more, you know, is real to us rather than some, like,
exactly
fantasy shit, you know?
Well, let's hear your spin. What's the first song you're going to play?
The first song that we're going to play is going to be Face the Fat.
Face the Fat.
Right, but we're going to do an introduction that we usually do at live shows, which is going to go into Face the Fat.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, great. Well, here we go. Hungry Ass Youth at Danger Boy Record Studios in Silver Lake, live on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, weighing a combined total of 666 pounds, I give you Hungry Ass Hold the SUV, hold the dead.
Fuck yes.
Hell yeah. That was cool.
That was cool. So, for those who don't know much about the SGV punk scene, what's it like? What are the backyard shows like? What do people not know about it?
Well, we want
it's still fucking alive and kicking, man. When anybody says, I've heard people say from LA, you know, like the central LA area, saying like, oh, like punk is dead in like certain areas, including ours. But nah, man, I think SGV has kept going for a really long time. There's still backyard gigs like every other week. A lot of club shows like VFW Hall. We're playing one.
VFW, American Legion. We're actually playing one coming up July 5th in Baldwin Park, which is the hub that the city's nickname is the hub of the San Gabriel Valley. So, so yeah, we're playing that July 5th with a bunch of rad bands. San Gabriel Valley hardcore punk, it thrives. I don't know. I feel like it doesn't get a lot of attention. Like other, like the South Bay has a good scene. I mean, you got also like even Oxnard, like that, like the Nardcore. I feel like San Gabriel Valley, even I would even say like IE, Riverside, like we don't get like a lot of attention because we're east. We're east of LA.
SGV gets overshadowed by East LA, all these exactly. East Coast punk and shit.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
But what keeps it going though? I mean, if you feel that you got that. I mean, having a chip on your shoulder is a great way to have a punk band.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, like, beyond that, why are there so many bands that are still there putting it out? Why does the community keep thriving?
I think because the kids still have heart. And, you know, if a young kid picks up, you know, his older brother's DRI tape or something, you know, and he feels it, genuinely is into it, he's going to want to pick up a guitar and, you know, start his own band. You know, it might suck in the beginning, but, you know, as long as the heart's there, playing in the backyards, you know, that's all it takes.
I would say in the camaraderie. Like, I mean, I've known this guy since I was a teenager, and it's kind of crazy going from being 18 to now, like, our 30s, and we've seen each other grow up. All these guys, Josh and yep. Travis, we met each other very young, and, like, we've all remained tight friends, and I kind of love that idea, you know, that we're like a brotherhood. Yeah. You guys want to say something? Travis, what do you think, man? About the SGV, you get these guys played in a different. When we first started Hungry Ass Youth, they were their own band.
Yeah, they were called Downright Aggression
from Monrovia, which is another city in the SGV.
Yeah,
right.
Smallest Danny Rodriguez.
Danny Rodriguez,
wherever he is.
Smallest city in.
R.I.P. No, just kidding. He's still alive.
But what do you think about the scene, and why do you love it so much?
I love it because it's like it brings us all together. You know. Just playing shows, even if there's not a huge crowd there. I mean, the bands that do show up, like, we all get along, like, and sometimes we catch bands that are fresh, and, I mean, then, you know, they become friends also, you know, and it's like a never-ending cycle, but, like, just the friendship we have, like, in San Gabriel Valley, LA area, just all around, surrounding areas, it's great, you know?
And, yeah, we're tired.
I mean, I love that sense of community, and I love that sense of just creating stuff, even if it's for each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you create the best stuff, when you're not thinking, oh, will this get popular? Will this be exciting to someone else outside of the scene? You're making stuff for the community.
Right.
Yeah, making music for like-minded people and people who like the same kind of shit that we do. Yep. Have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
It's very important.
We're funny guys. Yeah, go ahead, Travis.
Nothing. I was just gonna say, yeah. All my best friends are from punk rock and hardcore. I don't make new friends.
Damn, Travis.
No new friends. I'm all filled up on friends. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
That top eight is full up.
There you go.
Now the other amazing export of the SGV is food. And as boys who are super into food, what are your favorite places to eat there? And then also, what are the places that, if you aren't from the SGV, you do not know about? And of course, I want them so I can go eat there, but if you don't feel like giving up your favorite secrets, I also understand. Nah,
there was a place called Mr. Pizza. It has a different name now.
In El Monte, right?
Yeah, in El Monte. I think it's called The One. It's under new management, but growing up, that was a pizza place to go to.
Why, though? What was special about the pizza?
It was dirt cheap, one. You can get two large pizzas for the price of one, but the fucking crust was good. Like, I would eat the whole shit.
It was like a buttery crust or what?
These guys make fun of me because they say, oh, Flea doesn't eat crust. My reasoning for that is because I like to eat more of the pie than everybody else. Fair. So I'll save the crust for last. So I'll you know, that's the only time that I apply like mathematics. Like, all right, if this guy's eating at a rate, you know, I gotta eat more than him. So I'll save the crust for last because it doesn't have cheese.
Now I'm starving. Can we order a pizza here?
Yeah. We got Silver Lake Pizza.
All right.
I wanted to say one of my favorite spots.
Go ahead, hit it. There's still time.
I love eating, you know, pizza is one, but Mexican food. I love tacos. Oh, yeah. Growing up, there was a little taco Mexican truck food in Highland Park called El Pique. That was like my go-to taco truck. It's under new management now, and I don't know if they changed the salsa or whatever, or the carne asada is not like made the same. So, but I want to give a shout out to my homie Javier, to Cabral. He's a food critic. And he's actually shown me a lot of good food.
Yeah.
In the SUV especially, we have the barbecue place. The barbecue place? Or Robbins?
Yeah.
Which one?
They're here in LA.
Do you have the mic, man?
I'm talking.
The barbecue place? I don't know what barbecue place you're talking about.
If you don't know it,
East LA Barbecue.
East LA Barbecue.
Shout out.
Yeah, East LA Barbecue, man.
We're also sponsored by El Taco Man, El Mero Mero Taquero.
that's his neighbor's business.
Yeah, they're good friends of mine. They always hook it up. They're the first tacos dorados.
There is that good overlap of, you know, affordable, good Mexican food and dumplings and pizza and things like that, and hardcore punk bands.
Yeah.
I mean, it really supports each other. Especially, I remember growing up and knowing where all the, you know, in Philadelphia, where all the places where you could go after a show to get good food that wasn't crazy expensive.
We had that in South El Monte. It was a place called Omañas. For those who don't know, was a place, I would say infamous, because their burritos always gave you chorro, diarrhea.
Dirty ass place, yeah.
Yeah, the place was open till like awesome. 4 in the morning, so, you know, you'd see a bunch of like hookers and drug addicts there at 4 in the morning, but it was great. It was a good place.
It was great.
Another good, legit burger spot, dude, is down the street from where I live. What's it called? The metal burger place.
Metal burger. Oh yeah, Grill 'Em All.
Yeah, Grill 'Em All.
Oh yeah, Grill 'Em All.
They took like the hardcore metal ethos. Whatever. Yeah, and then they put it with food, and I love going down there. I mean, I don't eat out all the time, but
if anybody from Grill 'Em All hears us, we want a burger named after us. that place is
Hungry
a fine establishment.
I mean, I need a Hungry Ass Youth Burger.
Coming soon, Hungry Ass
Youth
Burger.
Oh yeah, dude.
All right, let's get another song in.
Yeah, let's do it.
What do you got next?
Our next song was Dinosaurs.
Okay. So
one of your
uncle's songs, right?
Actually, this is the first song I ever wrote, ever, when I was 14. Parts of it, not the whole thing. But the idea was like when I was from a teenager, and so I'm very happy that we're still doing it now.
Awesome. Alright, here we go. Dinosaurs by Hungry Ass Youth on Snacky Tunes.
I'm going down, about.
It reminds me of Warzone.
It's a good shred. What I love about your lyrics is you guys put your money where your mouth is and sing a lot about food.
Yes.
Food.
Oh. I mean, not fruit. One and the same. I haven't heard a lot of fruit lyrics.
Pineapple on
I've never
pizza.
Tried fruit. Yeah.
Is there bacon on that?
Yeah. But why do you guys love singing about food? What do you love about writing about food?
Everything.
Everybody likes food. That's why. You know.
Yeah. I love eating food. I live to eat. You know, so I'm always, yeah, dude.
No.
Eat to live, live to eat.
Some people could give a shit about eating. They're just like, oh, I got my next meal, whatever. Yeah. I'm currently always thinking about my next meal.
Yeah, I'd rather not associate myself with those type of people, to be honest.
There's two types of people that I've met who I go, I want nothing to do with you. One is the people who go, I don't care what we eat. And the person who goes, I'm not really into music. And I go, what?
Wow.
I've never met anyone who said both, because then I go, what do you do? I don't know. No. But what do you love about, you know, when you guys start writing about food and when you guys thinking about writing about food, like what inspires you?
I think it came from a time where me and Jesse were getting really drunk at BJ's. They make pizza there. We were getting really fucked up, and we came up with the idea of, why don't we start a band that talks about overeating, gluttony, you know, anti-health? And I wanted to call the band Food Fight because I was just imagining this raging band that, like, just, you know, over the top. And Jesse came up with the name Hungry Ass Youth. And but that's the day that it came. Mm-hmm. We came up with the idea, and then we got a couple of musicians who wanted to try out, and then we started writing the songs originally. And we went through, like, what, three drummers?
We've been through a number of players, that's for sure. But, I mean, we love to eat food. Like I said earlier, we're a culture, even if, you know, in the San Gabriel Valley, I guess, we love to eat food. Well, we like to eat and socialize. And there was a time period where we had, like, this crew of friends, and we would meet up at 399 Pizza, which was in Baldwin Park.
Oh, yeah.
And we would, there was, like, 20, maybe 30 of us. Like, we would go do softball.
Yeah, we would play baseball first, yeah.
Right, and then the after party was at 399 Pizza, our local pizzeria.
Pitchers and 399
Pizza. Right, get a bunch of pitchers, a beer, and then just eating pizza.
It's the poor man's Shakey's. So imagine a bunch of, soccer moms and, Little League baseball teams, you know, enjoying themselves, and then here comes 30 fucking punk rockers,
punks and skins, tattooed, overweight,
scooting their kids
sweaty.
A lot closer.
Yeah.
You guys cook a lot too?
I'm actually starting to cook a lot more because my wife is forcing me.
She's like, same here.
You've grown up a spoiled little brat. Your mom has been taking care of you, so now you're gonna cook. So,
same here, man. Shout out to my mom for making the best.
Shout
Mexican
out to Flea's
food.
Mom, bomb tamales.
What's your mom? Your mom makes.
My mom makes everything. She's got like.
She's got the best
everything,
salsa ever.
The best salsa, Josh knows.
Sauce.
Whenever I go visit my mom, I take a full Ziploc bag of her homemade green salsa. She roasts the chilies. It looks like nothing that you can get like at a store. It's like big chunks of tomato.
Oh, yeah.
She sells tamales.
I noticed
time.
That there's no bag of salsa here, so...
Had I known, I would have brought a whole barbecue.
My mom usually makes a tub. If you see like a container... Like a random like sour cream container, you open that up, there's salsa in there.
Yeah.
Like last week they were having like a serious ass conversation, and I just like randomly was like, "Hey, your mom got any of that salsa?"
Hey, she's on deck, homie. Hit me up.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt this conversation, but does your mom have salsa?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to taste your mom's salsa.
No, about the cooking. I love to cook. I love to cook. Living alone, I mean, I don't get to cook all the time, but when I do. I mean, I'd say my best friend would be the crock pot, man.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Chili.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Travis doesn't cook. That's good.
I do cook. Pressure cooker hardcore. That's what I
Fuck yeah. That's a new song right there.
I throw everything in one pressure cooker, and it's done.
That's
20 minutes.
I don't mess around with that. I'm always afraid I'm going to blow my face off.
Throw a ham sandwich in a fucking
pressure
cooker.
Might have an accident one day, but
So, wait. Now that you're cooking, what are you cooking?
Like, My lady has me doing a lot of sautéing. So I get like a lot of onions, I'll mince garlic, I'll throw in like bell peppers. And then that'll usually accompany some type of meat, you know? And then I'll have to like put it in the oven like some bread, you know? Like I'm not like overly complicated.
That sounds good.
But I'm getting there, you know? But my wife's more the cook. Meat in the oven? Right. Like, I didn't know what a charcuterie was. And And I learned, like, a charcuterie, which were like the sliced meats and
very
cheeses.
Very fancy deli platter.
Right.
And sounds fancy.
I didn't grow up on that kind of stuff. You know, I came from a working class family, but my lady did. She came from like vineyards and all that good stuff. And I love charcuterie. Like, I'll have charcuterie for dinner.
You got to make some for the band, man.
Yeah. I'll get that. What is that? The wild boar? Boar's head?
Oh, yeah.
Boar's head meat?
Compromise elsewhere.
Boar's head. So before we get to our last song, one of the best stories I've ever heard about you guys is that at your very first show, you brought pizza, and there were guys eating slices in the pit.
Right.
Pizza pit.
Yep.
How often are you bringing food to your shows?
Oh, man.
We don't really do it that much anymore, but yeah, in the beginning we did it.
When we didn't have to pay so much on our bills and I don't know what else, we would bring a lot more food. Not just pizza, we would bring hamburgers from
McDoubles at
McDonald's
people.
McDonald's or whatever.
Yeah, fastballing fucking cheeseburgers at people in the
pit. Fastball McDouble.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
not a bad song, Fastball McDoubles.
It's on our next album.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, man, we had our first backyard gig, as a matter of fact. We brought, five pizzas.
Like two gigantes from La Pizza Loca.
Oh, yeah, that was...
Which is a local pizza place.
Bang for your buck. It was cool because there's pictures of a dusty-ass backyard pit and people holding up slices in the air. There's even a picture of James Yappo, who's... it's a band that I'm in. He's holding up the pizza box to see if there's anything left. And there's nothing. It got eaten up. It was like a wall-to-wall pit. The pit was huge.
That's because you were eating the crust last and eating all that pizza.
I was hoarding the crust behind my amp.
There's a show not that long ago. The kids had pizza and they had signed pizza boxes and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
We did a set list on a pizza box.
Dude, that's awesome.
That was like, oh, okay, the next song.
It wasn't that legible because of all the grease stains. But
Well, I want to thank you guys for coming. If people want to find your music or find you online or go to your next show, where can they find you?
If you go to Google or any internet search engine, just type in Hungry, H-U-N-G-R-Y, Ass, A-S-S, Youth, Y-O-U-T-H. We're on all the social live
shows. Jesse doesn't think much of our listeners.
Very, very searchable name.
So we're on YouTube. We have TuneCore, so... You can find us everywhere.
Instagram.
Spotify, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Next time you go out for pizza, throw that on the playlist, right?
There you go.
Well, I want to thank Danger Bird Records, always. I want to thank...
Thank you, Danger Bird.
Andy in the studio, Kong, Greg.
Thank you, guys.
Thank Javier for connecting us.
Yeah,
AKA Gluster. The Glutster.
And his lady. His lady, Paola. She's an amazing cook.
Oh, yeah. And the last song you got has to do with pizza, right?
This song came off our original demo. Back in 1986. But yeah, pizza. And we're going to re-recorded it the right way.
Yeah. Guy, hey, and if any of you collectors out there have that original cassette tape, I'm willing to pay top dollar.
I'm sure you'll find it on eBay soon, man. Trust me.
How'd you fund your tour? We found a whole stash of demos. All right, thank you, guys. We'll see you next time on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Two more pizzas!
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.